This contact was not established at Rochester, but rather at Stratford in Connecticut, where Davis was a witness of the poltergeist phenomena which broke out in the household of a clergyman, Dr. Phelps, in the early months of 1850. A study of these led him to write a pamphlet, The Philosophy of Spiritual Intercourse, expanded afterwards to a book which contains much which the world has not yet mastered. Some of it, in its wise restraint, may also be commended to some spiritualists. Spiritualism is useful as a living demonstration of a future existence, he says. Spirits have aided me many times, but they do not control either my person or my reason. They can and do perform kindly offices for those on earth. But benefits can only be secured on the condition that we allow them to become our teachers and not our masters, so that we accept them as companions, not as gods to be worshipped. Wise words and a modern restatement of the vital remark of St. Paul that the prophet must not be subject to his own gifts. In order to explain adequately the life of Davis, one has to ascend to supernormal conditions. But even then there are alternative explanations. When one considers the following undeniable facts: 1. That he claims to have seen and heard the materialized form of Swedenborg before he knew anything of his teachings. 2. That something possessed this ignorant youth, which gave him great knowledge. 3. That this knowledge took the same broad sweeping universal lines which were characteristic of Swedenborg. 4. But that they went one step farther, having added just that knowledge of spirit power which Swedenborg may have attained after his death. Considering these 4 points, then, is it not a feasible hypothesis that the power which controlled Davis was actually Swedenborg? It would be well if the estimable but very narrow and limited New Church took such possibilities into account. But whether Davis stood alone, or whether he was the reflection of one greater than himself, the fact remains that he was a miracle man, the inspired, learned, uneducated apostle of the new dispensation. So permanent has been his influence that the well-known artist and critic Mr. E. Wake Cook, in his remarkable book Retrogression in Art, harks back to Davis's teaching as the one modern influence which could recast the world. Davis left his mark deep upon spiritualism. Summerland, for example, as a name for the modern paradise, and the whole system of Lyceum schools with their ingenious organization, are of his devising. As Mr. Basidon and Butt has remarked, even today the full and final extent of his influence is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to assess. 4. At the Hydesville episode. We have now traced various disconnected and irregular uprushes of psychic force in the cases which have been set forth, and we come at last to the particular episode which was really on a lower level than those which had gone before, but which occurred within the ken of a practical people who found means to explore it thoroughly and to introduce reason and system into what had been a mere object of aimless wonder. It is true that the circumstances were lowly, the actors humble, the place remote, and the communication sordid, being based on no higher motive than revenge. When, however, in the everyday affairs of this world one wishes to test whether a telegraphic wire is in operation, one notices whether a message comes through, and the high or low nature of that message is quite a secondary consideration. It is said that the first message which actually came through the transatlantic cable was a commonplace inquiry from the testing engineer. Nonetheless, kings and presidents have used it since. So it is that the humble spirit of the murdered peddler of Hydesville may have opened a gap into which the angels have thronged. There is good and bad and all that is intermediate on the other side as on this side of the veil. The company you attract depends upon yourself and your own motives. Hydesville is a typical little hamlet of New York State, with a primitive population which was, no doubt, half-educated, but was probably, like the rest of those small American centers of life, more detached from prejudice and more receptive of new ideas than any other set of people at that time. This particular village, situated about 20 miles from the rising town of Rochester, consisted of a cluster of wooden houses of a very humble type. It was in one of these, a residence which would certainly not pass the requirements of a British District Council surveyor, that they began this development which is already, in the opinion of many, by far the most important thing that America has given to the commonweal of the world. It was inhabited by a decent farmer family of the name of Folks, or name which, by a curious coincidence, has already been registered in religious history as that of the Apostle of the Quakers. Besides the father and mother, who were Methodists in religion, there were two children resident in the house at the time when the manifestations reached such a point of intensity that they attracted general attention. These children were the daughters A. Margaret, aged 14, and Kate, aged 11. There were several other children out in the world, of whom only one, Leah, who was teaching music in Rochester, need come into this narrative. The little house had already established a somewhat uncanny reputation. The evidence to this effect was collected and published very shortly after the event, and seems to be as reliable as such evidence can be. In view of the extreme importance of everything which bears upon the matter, some extracts from these depositions must be inserted, but to avoid dislocation of the narrative, the evidence upon this point has been relegated to the appendix. We will therefore pass at once to the time of the tenancy of the Fox family, who took over the house on December 11, 1847. It was not until the next year that the sounds heard by the previous tenants began once more. These sounds consisted of rapping noises. A rap would seem to be the not unnatural sound to be produced by outside visitors when they wished to notify their presence at the door of human life and desire that door to be opened for them. Just such raps, all unknown to these unread farmers, had occurred in England in 1661 at the house of Mr. Mompesson, at Tedworth. Raps, too, are recorded by Melanchthon as having occurred at Oppenheim, in Germany, in 1520, and raps were heard at the Epworth Vicarage in 1716. Here they were once more, and at last they were destined to have the closed door open. Seducismus triumphatus, by Reverend Joseph Glanville. The noises do not seem to have incommoded the Fox family until the middle of March, 1848. From that date onwards they continually increased in intensity. Sometimes they were a mere knocking, at other times they sounded like the movement of furniture. The children were so alarmed that they refused to sleep apart and were taken into the bedroom of their parents. So vibrant were the sounds that the beds thrilled and shook. Every possible search was made, the husband waiting on one side of the door and the wife on the other, but the rappings still continued. It was soon noticed that daylight was inimical to the phenomena, and this naturally strengthened the idea of trickery, but every possible solution was tested and failed. Finally, upon the night of March 31, there was a very loud and continued outbreak of inexplicable sounds. It was on this night that one of the great points of psychic evolution was reached, for it was then that young Kate Fox challenged the unseen power to repeat the snaps of her fingers. That rude room, with its earnest, expectant, half-clad occupants with eager upturned faces, its circle of candlelight, and its heavy shadows lurking in the corners, might well be made the subject of a great historical painting. Search all the palaces and chancelleries of 1848, and where will you find a chamber which has made its place in history as secure as this little bedroom of a shack? The child's challenge, though given with flippant words, was instantly answered. Every snap was echoed by a knock. However humble the operator at either end, the spiritual telegraph was at last working, and it was left to the patience and moral earnestness of the human race to determine how high might be the uses to which it was put in the future. Unexplained forces were many in the world, but here was a force claiming to have independent intelligence at the back of it. That was the supreme sign of a new departure. Mrs. Fox was amazed at this development, and at the further discovery that the force could apparently see as well as hear, for when Kate snapped her fingers without sound the rap still responded. The mother asked a series of questions, the answers to which, given in numerals, showed a greater knowledge of her own affairs than she herself possessed, for the Rapps insisted that she had had 7 children, whereas she protested that she had borne only 6, until one who had died early came back to her mind. A neighbor, Mrs. Redfield, was called in, and her amusement was changed to wonder, and finally to awe, as she also listened to correct answers to intimate questions. The neighbors came flocking in as some rumors of these wonders got about, and the 2 children were carried off by one of them, while Mrs. Fox went to spend the night at Mrs. Redfield's. In their absence the phenomena went on exactly the same as before, which disposes once for all of those theories of cracking toes and dislocating knees which have been so frequently put forward by people unaware of the true facts. Having formed a sort of informal committee of investigation, the crowd, in shrewd Yankee fashion, spent a large part of the night of March 31st in playing question and answer with the unseen intelligence. According to its own account, he was a spirit, he had been injured in that house, he rapped out the name of a former occupant who had injured him, he was 31 years old at the time of death, which was 5 years before, he had been murdered for money, he had been buried in the cellar 10 feet deep. On descending to the cellar, dull, heavy thumps, coming apparently from under the earth, broke out when the investigator stood at the center. There was no sound at other times. That, then, was the place of burial. It was a neighbor named Bzla who, first of all modern men, called over the alphabet and got answers by raps on the letters. In this way the name of the dead man was obtained, A. Charles B. Rosmer. The idea of connected messages was not developed until 4 months later, when Isaac Post, a Quaker, of Rochester, was the pioneer. These, in very brief outline, were the events of March 31st, which were continued and confirmed upon the succeeding night, when not fewer than a couple of hundred people had assembled round the house. Upon April 2nd it was observed that the raps came in the day as well as at night. Such is a synopsis of the events of the night of March 31st, 1848, but as it was the small root out of which sprang so great a tree, and as this whole volume may be said to be a monument to its memory, it would seem fitting that the story should be given in the very words of the 2 original adult witnesses. Their evidence was taken within 4 days of the occurrence, and forms part of that admirable piece of psychic research upon the part of the local committee which will be described and commented upon later. Mrs. Fox deposed, on the night of the first disturbance we all got up, lighted a candle and searched the entire house, the noises continuing during the time, and being heard near the same place. Although not very loud, it produced a jar of the bedsteads and chairs that could be felt when we were in bed. It was a tremulous motion, more than a sudden jar. We could feel the jar when standing on the floor. It continued on this night until we slept. I did not sleep until about 12 o'clock. On March 30th we were disturbed all night. The noises were heard in all parts of the house. My husband stationed himself outside of the door while I stood inside, and the knocks came on the door between us. We heard footsteps in the pantry, and walking downstairs, we could not rest, and I then concluded that the house must be haunted by some unhappy restless spirit. I had often heard of such things, but had never witnessed anything of the kind that I could not account for before. On Friday night, March 31st, 1848, we concluded to go to bed early and not permit ourselves to be disturbed by the noises, but try and get a night's rest. My husband was here on all these occasions, heard the noises, and helped search. It was very early when we went to bed on this night, a hardly dark. I had been so broken of my rest I was almost sick. My husband had not gone to bed when we first heard the noise on this evening. I had just lain down. It commenced as usual. I knew it from all other noises I had ever heard before. The children, who slept in the other bed in the room, heard the rapping, and tried to make similar sounds by snapping their fingers. My youngest child, Kathy, said, "Mr. Splitfoot, do as I do," clapping her hands. The sound instantly followed her with the same number of raps. When she stopped, the sound ceased for a short time. Then Margareta said, in sport, now, do just as I do. Count 1, 2, 3, 4, striking one hand against the other at the same time, and the raps came as before. She was afraid to repeat them. Then Kathy said in her childish simplicity, oh, mother, I know what it is. Tomorrow is April Fool Day, and it's somebody trying to fool us. I then thought I could put a test that no one in the place could answer. I asked the noise to rap my different children's ages, successively. Instantly, each one of my children's ages was given correctly, pausing between them sufficiently long to individualize them until the seventh, at which a longer pause was made, and then three more emphatic raps were given, corresponding to the age of the little one that died, which was my youngest child. I then asked, is this a human being that answers my questions so correctly? There was no rap. I asked, is it a spirit? If it is, make two raps. Two sounds were given as soon as the request was made. I then said if it was an injured spirit, make two raps, which were instantly made, causing the house to tremble. I asked, were you injured in this house? The answer was given as before. Is the person living that injured you? Answered by raps in the same manner. I ascertained by the same method that it was a man, aged 31 years, that he had been murdered in this house, and his remains were buried in the cellar, that his family consisted of a wife and five children, two sons and three daughters, all living at the time of his death, but that his wife had since died. I asked, will you continue to rap if I call my neighbors that they may hear it too? The raps were loud in the affirmative. My husband went and called in Mrs. Redfield, our nearest neighbor. She is a very candid woman. The girls were sitting up in bed clinging to each other, and trembling with terror. I think I was as calm as I am now. Mrs. Redfield came immediately, this was about 7:30, thinking she would have a laugh at the children. But when she saw them pale with fright, and nearly speechless, she was amazed, and believed there was something more serious than she had supposed. I asked a few questions for her, and was answered as before. He told her age exactly. She then called her husband, and the same questions were asked and answered. Then Mr. Redfield called in Mr. Dzler and wife, and several others. Mr. Dzler then called in Mr. and Mrs. Hyde, also Mr. and Mrs. Jewell. Mr. Dzler asked many questions, and received answers. I then named all the neighbors I could think of, and asked if any of them had injured him, and received no answer. Mr. Dzler then asked questions and received answers. He asked, were you murdered? Raps affirmative. Can your murderer be brought to justice? No sound. Can he be punished by the law? No answer. He then said, if your murderer cannot be punished by the law, manifest it by raps, and the raps were made clearly and distinctly. In the same way, Mr. Dzler ascertained that he was murdered in the east bedroom about 5 years ago and that the murder was committed by a Mr. on a Tuesday night at 12 o'clock, that he was murdered by having his throat cut with a butcher knife, that the body was taken down to the cellar, that it was not buried until the next night, that it was taken through the buttery, down the stairway, and that it was buried 10 feet below the surface of the ground. It was also ascertained that he was murdered for his money, by raps affirmative. How much was it? 100. No rap. Was it 200? Etc. And when he mentioned 500, the raps replied in the affirmative. Many called in who were fishing in the creek, and all heard the same questions and answers. Many remained in the house all night. I and my children left the house. My husband remained in the house with Mr. Redfield all night. On the next Saturday the house was filled to overflowing. There were no sounds heard during day, but they commenced again in the evening. It was said that there were over 300 persons present at the time. On Sunday morning the noises were heard throughout the day by all who came to the house. On Saturday night, April 1st, they commenced digging in the cellar, they dug until they carried it to water, and then gave it up. The noise was not heard on Sunday evening nor during the night. Stephen B. Smith and wife, my daughter Marie, and my son David S. Fox and wife, slept in the room this night. I have heard nothing since that time until yesterday. In the forenoon of yesterday there were several questions answered in the usual way by rapping. I have heard the noise several times today. I am not a believer in haunted houses or supernatural appearances. I am very sorry that there has been so much excitement about it. It has been a great deal of trouble to us. It was our misfortune to live here at this time, but I am willing and anxious that the truth should be known, and that a true statement should be made. I cannot account for these noises. All that I know is that they have been heard repeatedly, as I have stated. I have heard this rapping again this Tuesday morning, April 4th. My children also heard it. I certify that the foregoing statement has been read to me, and that the same is true, and that I should be willing to take my oath that it is so, if necessary. Signed, Margaret Fox. April 11, 1848. Statement by John D. Fox. I have heard the above statement of my wife, Margaret Fox, read, and hereby certify that the same is true in all its particulars. I heard the same rappings which she has spoken of, in answer to the questions, as stated by her. There have been a great many questions besides those asked, and answered in the same way. Some have been asked a great many times, and they have always received the same answers. There has never been any contradiction whatever. I do not know of any way to account for those noises, as being caused by any natural means. We have searched every nook and corner in and about the house, at different times, to ascertain, if possible, whether anything or anybody was secreted there that could make the noise, and have not been able to find anything which would or could explain the mystery. It has caused a great deal of trouble and anxiety. Hundreds have visited the house, so that it is impossible for us to attend to our daily occupations, and I hope that, whether caused by natural or supernatural means, it will be ascertained soon. The digging in the cellar will be resumed as soon as the water settles, and then it can be ascertained whether there are any indications of a body ever having been buried there, and if there are, I shall have no doubt but that it is of supernatural origin. Signed, John D. Fox. April 11, 1848, the neighbors had formed themselves into a committee of investigation, which for sanity and efficiency might be a lesson to many subsequent researchers. They did not begin by imposing their own conditions, but they started without prejudice to record the facts exactly as they found them. Not only did they collect and record the impressions of everyone concerned, but they actually had the evidence in printed form within a month of the occurrence. The author has in vain attempted to get an original copy of the pamphlet, A Report of the Mysterious Noises Heard in the House of Mr. John D. Fox, published at Canandaigua, New York, but he has been presented with a facsimile of the original, and it is his considered opinion that the fact of human survival and power of communication was definitely proved to any mind capable of weighing evidence from the day of the appearance of that document. 71. The statement made by Mr. Dzler, chief of the committee, gives important testimony to the occurrence of the noises and jars in the absence of the Fox girls from the house, and disposes once and forever of all suspicion of their complicity in these events. Mrs. Fox, as we have seen, referring to the night of Friday, March 31st, said, I and my children left the house. Part of Mr. Dzler's statement reads, I live within a few rods of the house in which these sounds have been heard. The first I heard anything about them was a week ago last Friday evening, March 31st. Mrs. Redfield came over to my house to get my wife to go over to Mrs. Fox's. Mrs. R. appeared to be very much agitated. My wife wanted me to go over with them, and I accordingly went. This was about 9 o'clock in the evening. There were some 12 or 14 persons present when I left them. Some were so frightened that they did not want to go into the room. I went into the room and sat down on the bed. Mr. Fox asked a question and I heard the rapping, which they had spoken of, distinctly. I felt the bedstead jar when the sounds were produced. The Honorable Robert Dale Owen, a member of the United States Congress, and formerly American minister to Naples, supplies a few additional particulars in his narrative, written after conversations with Mrs. Fox and her daughters, Margaret and Catherine. Describing the night of March 31, 1848, he says, "Footfalls, etc., p. 287, author of Footfalls on the Boundary of Another World, 1860, and The Debatable Land, 1871. The parents had had the children's beds removed into their bedroom, and strictly enjoined them not to talk of noises even if they heard them. But scarcely had the mother seen them safely in bed and was retiring to rest herself when the children cried out, 'Here they are again!' The mother chid them, and lay down. Thereupon the noises became louder and more startling. The children sat up in bed. Mrs. Fox called in her husband. The night being windy, it suggested itself to him that it might be the rattling of the sashes. He tried several, shaking them to see if they were loose. Kate, the youngest girl, happened to remark that as often as her father shook a window sash the noises seemed to reply. Being a lively child, and in a measure accustomed to what was going on, she turned to where the noise was, snapped her fingers, and called out, "Here, old Splitfoot, do as I do." The knocking instantly responded. That was the very commencement. Who can tell where the end will be? Mr. Mompesson, in bed with his little daughter, about Kate's age, whom the sound seemed chiefly to follow, observed that it would exactly answer, in drumming, anything that was beaten or called for. But his curiosity led him no further. Not so Kate Fox. She tried, by silently bringing together her thumb and forefinger, whether she could still obtain a response. Yes. It could see, then, as well as hear. She called her mother. "Only look, mother," she said, bringing together her finger and thumb as before. And as often as she repeated the noiseless motion, just so often responded the raps. In the summer of 1848 Mr. David Fox, with the assistance of Mr. Henry Bush, Mr. Lyman Granger, of Rochester, and others, resumed digging in the cellar. At a depth of 5 feet they found a plank, and further digging disclosed charcoal and quicklime, and finally human hair and bones, which were pronounced by expert medical testimony to belong to a human skeleton. It was not until 56 years later that a further discovery was made which proved beyond all doubt that someone had really been buried in the cellar of the Fox House. This statement appeared in the Boston Journal, a non-spiritualistic paper, of November 23, 1904, and runs as follows: Rochester, N.Y., November 22, 1904. The skeleton of the man supposed to have caused the rappings first heard by the Fox sisters in 1848 has been found in the walls of the house occupied by the sisters, and clears them from the only shadow of doubt held concerning their sincerity in the discovery of spirit communication. The Fox sisters declared they learned to communicate with the spirit of a man, and that he told them he had been murdered and buried in the cellar. Repeated excavations failed to locate the body and thus give proof positive of their story. The discovery was made by school children playing in the cellar of the building in Hydesville known as the Spook House, where the Fox sisters heard the wonderful rappings. William H. Hyde, a reputable citizen of Clyde, who owns the house, made an investigation and found an almost entire human skeleton between the earth and crumbling cellar walls. Undoubtedly that of the wandering peddler who, it was claimed, was murdered in the east room of the house, and whose body was hidden in the cellar. Mr. Hyde has notified relatives of the Fox sisters, and the notice of the discovery will be sent to the National Order of Spiritualists, many of whom remember having made pilgrimage to the Spook House, as it is commonly called. The finding of the bones practically corroborates the sworn statement made by Margaret Fox, April 11, 1848. There was discovered a peddler's tin box as well as the bones, and this box is now preserved at Lilydale, the central country headquarters of the American Spiritualists, to which also the old Hydesville house has been transported. These discoveries settle the question forever and prove conclusively that there was a crime committed in the house, and that this crime was indicated by psychic means. When one examines the result of the two diggings, one can reconstruct the circumstances. It is clear that in the first instance the body was buried with quicklime in the center of the cellar.